Our lesson today is based on the final chapter of Young and the Lost Gospels by Stephen Heller, which is actually the epilogue, entitled From Hiroshima to the Secret Gospels, the Alternative Future of Human History. And it is an interesting approach because it's kind of made a full circle. We started with the what he's calling the Secret Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels, and came around to where he comes to current time, which he's epitomizing in Hiroshima, the atom bomb. And then but instead of saying from the secret gospel to Hiroshima, he's saying Hiroshima to the secret gospels. In other words, having done that in terms of the timeline, he's looking at where do we go from the now to Gnosis. And the question really is all this Gnostic stuff relevant to us at the very end of the 20th century where we find ourselves now? I think it's a very good question. The Gnostic texts on which this book was based are 2,000 years old. And it's reasonable to ask, what did these people 2,000 years ago know that would be of such value to us in our, not only presumably, but truly more advanced state, psychologically, than people were 2,000 years ago. In saying that, I am not going to admit at this point that we're necessarily much more advanced than the Gnostics who wrote the text 2,000 years ago. I'm just leaving that hanging in the air for a few minutes. But we definitely are in a different psychological state, different cultural state, in totally different life circumstances than most people who lived 2,000 years ago. So the question is there a relevance? I think that we should start by applying this question to the Bible. In the Bible, we have texts, many of which are very much a part of their culture, of the time they were written, or even projecting back into the times of which they account, which are even earlier than when they were written, that are very much hooked into the timeline. And it would be very relevant to ask, well, what is their value to people living at the end of the 20th century? And personally, I have to say that if you approach them in that direction, I think the value tends to be negative, not even neutral. And therefore, we have fundamentalist Christianity with all its dangers to stable, intelligent society, because it's based on texts that come out of a whole different world, and then they're trying to slap those texts onto our culture today, and it just doesn't line up. And it creates very negative frictions, which are not helping us either psychologically or socially or even humanely. I see a real problem there. And interestingly, this is a problem from which the Gnostic texts are free, because they do not purport to be telling a story on the timeline, and they do not reflect the culture of the time in which they were written. They are mostly mythic tales that are overtly mythic, that overtly happen outside of time and space, and even the ones that do are placed within time and space, it's very ethereally so. For example, most of the accounts of Jesus' teaching in the Gnostic text are about Jesus' teaching after his resurrection. Why? Because it places him outside the timeline so that what he has to say is always relevant. Now, I'm not saying that that's some kind of a trick to make us think that. I'm saying that what he says in them, we find, is always relevant. We find it as relevant today as it would have been 2,000 years ago, because it doesn't deal with the minutiae of mortal life. It deals with the principles outside the limitations of the time or space you inhabit, and therefore they're always applicable within that time or space, whenever and wherever it may be. I think that is what is so important about approaching reality through the Gnostic texts. Now, some of the old Gnostic texts are so obtuse that they could make you cry trying to figure out what they're saying. I mean, they can get very complex. And so, and that maybe is one of the problems that can come out of not being centered in the timeline. It's easy to get lost in just ideas, concepts, and thoughts. But if you break through all that to what they're actually saying, you find that it is never limited in its relevancy by when it's being said. Because it's being said from a perspective that is outside of when. And that gives it an incredible value. And then when we come to those texts that don't have that limitation, where it's cut down to very clear concepts, they still have the advantage of being placed outside time and often even outside space, so that when we bring them in, wherever we are, they're just as alive as they ever were. I think that's the critical thing in relation to the topic of this chapter. Interesting, when this chapter was written, which was probably 20 years ago maybe, the big thing was that we were living in a world of potential nuclear conflict. And so, therefore, Hiroshima is brought in as an image, an important image, of the feeling, the cloud that humanity was living under at the time. And we are, to a large extent, out from under that now, because confrontation is not quite what's happening. Now, in real terms, it could the Holocaust spoken of in nuclear terms could happen just as well today as ever. It would be more freaky the way it would happen, but it could certainly happen. But it isn't a part of our daily thinking. It isn't a part of our daily planning. It isn't a part of our view of existence. So that even the very basis of the chapter is kind of out of date now. But the application of the Gnostic scriptures is not out of date. They're brought in and they're still relevant to today's circumstances, just as they were relevant to the circumstances in the 60s and 70s, just as they were relevant to the circumstances in the year 200 and the year 300. Because they apply to whatever circumstances, because they're short on mortal details, but long on eternal divine principles. Having said that, there were a couple of things in the chapter I thought were really significant. One of them was a quote from Jung, introduced by the author as a quote from Jung himself. But anyway, I'll just say from Jung. Whoever speaks of the reality of the soul or psyche is accused of psychologism. Psychology is spoken of as if it were only psychology and nothing else. The notion that there can be psychic factors which correspond to divine figures is regarded as a devaluation of the latter. It smacks of blasphemy to think that a religious experience is a psychic process. Faced with this situation, we must really ask, how do we know so much about the psyche that we can say only psychic? I think this is very important because it's something that everyone has to deal with in growth, if we're growing beyond the literal-mindedness of Orthodox Christianity, or Orthodox any religious system. When we begin to deal with the eternal or divine realities within ourselves, then we have to be able to become clear that that doesn't make them less real, or that that doesn't make them less functioning, or that that in no way devalues them. That we're not talking of something less than God, if you will, because we're talking about the divine within us. In fact, in every way, we are talking about that which is greater. So when the Gnostics say that God, if you will, a term we rarely use because to us it seems to have little meaning, but that which is divine anthropos, meaning that which we are as human, the best in us, lifted up to even a higher level, then they are not bringing the deity down. They're not doing something blasphemous, as Jung says, which means bringing the deity down to our level. They are lifting us up in our potential to that divine level. Rather than this being a decrease of the divine, it is an increase of the human. Because the human is potentially the best of all there is. The human is potentially divine. And that's a very small distinction in some ways, and one that can be easily overlooked, but it's critical to being able to grow in gnosis. The realization that only when we see things within ourselves as being the greatest reality there is, it being the reality, are we able to deal with that reality, to relate to that reality. It's the opening of the doors. It's not bringing things down. So, well, I'm reminded of a Gnostic text, in fact, which doesn't say this exactly, but relates. Says that we say that, or people say that God created mankind, but the truth is that mankind creates their gods by projecting them from their minds. Now, the Gnostic difference is that knowing that, we don't have to project them from our minds out there where they take on a psychic power of their own and become, more often than not, negative deities of wrath and vengeance and those who are trying to trip mankind up. But realizing that that's the reality, we can let the divine be in us, where it is able to open up in terms of all the virtues of goodness and power and light. So it's really an extremely important realization, and it's one that we should not ever be hesitant about in dealing with those who might be seeking, that we are not looking for the divine out there. And we are not going to lead them to the divine out there. We are going to lead them through looking for the divine within, to the divine which is within, which is the only place that they can relate to the divine, and the only place that the divine can transform them. I think that's most basic to everything we're doing and learning. And one more statement at the very end of this chapter. Now, this was a statement from the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. There's a similar statement, considerably more abbreviated, I believe, in the sayings of Jesus, but it has the same general idea. When you make the two one, and when you make the inmost as the outermost, and the outer as the inner, and the above as the below, and when you make the male and female into a single unity, so the male will not be only male, and the female will not be only female, and so forth, then surely will you enter the kingdom. The kingdom being that place where you are in unity with the divine. And it will be when you transcend division. When you see that the opposites are only different manifestations or different sides of the same, if you will. When you understand that everything is in terms of the symbol of duality and not of separateness. It's interesting that sometimes the symbol of duality can be corresponded with the two serpents holding on to each other's tails. If you were to take just the one serpent, it could bite you. But as long as the two serpents are locked together, they're not a power. There is no way there is a power for harm there. That is, the poisonous serpent is balanced by the non-poisonous serpent. And you have something that is complete and growing and whole. Well, this is saying as long as you see things in terms of division, as long as you see people as male and female, as long as it makes a difference to you whether someone is a man or a woman, as long as, technically, as long as you see time in terms of night and day, there are all these things where we separate things. And as long as that is true, you don't enter into that peace of reality. You don't enter into wholeness. So in order for us to be whole, we have to perceive wholeness in everything, which everything is whole. Now, I don't mean there aren't things that are separated within the wholeness, but I do mean it's not supposed to be that way. It's not natural for it to be that way. That only when things transcend their separateness so that they become whole can true reality be found. And only when true reality is found do we enter into peace, do we enter into our relationship with the divine. Does the divine nature within us gain the ascendancy? Because what keeps us from being truly divine? The separations within our psyche. The divisions there. That divine part of us is kept hidden, is kept unconscious. That we make distinctions so that we have the shadow. That we define ourselves as male or female, so that we have repressed a half of our basic nature. All of these divisions keep us from being divine. And only when we're whole, and every part of us is working together harmoniously, does divinity become a reality. I think that's the important, those are the important aspects in the summing up of this text. I think it's been a very valuable run through the ancient Gnostic texts to see what was coming out in them. Not because it's important to us that anything was in the ancient Gnostic texts, but because we find that when people transcend their cultural limitations and hook into what the realities of our nature, our human nature and our potentially divine nature are, we come to the same basic insights. Whether we lived 2,000 years ago, or now at the end of this millennium, or any other time. We in our human nature, while human nature has expanded over the centuries, it is still basically the same. And the way to transcend human nature is absolutely the same. And as we hook into that, and we step out of time anyway, and we step out of space anyway, and we find ourselves in the eternal reality, which all these texts, ancient and modern, unfold to us. Amen.
Amen.